This podcast is sponsored by Rask Invest, Owen's complete guide to money and investing. Rask Invest members receive Owen's official investment ideas, research on budgets, banking, super and insurance, plus how-to guides to get started. Visit the Rask Finance website to learn more and join today.
Hello and thanks for tuning in to the Australian Investors Podcast, a series exploring the investment philosophies and journeys of some of Australia's leading investors and financial thinkers. I'm Owen Raskovich, founder of the Rask Group. For show notes and other episodes in this series, as well as free educational resources, please visit www.raskfinance.com. Before we go on, it's important to remember the Australian Investors Podcast is provided for educational purposes only and should not be relied upon to make an investment, financial, or taxation decision. The information included in this podcast does not take into account your needs, goals, or objectives, and guests appearing on the show may have a financial interest in some of the products mentioned. Please read all the important disclosure documents and refer to the Rask Group's financial services guide on the Rask Finance website. Chad Slater is the co-founder of Morphic Asset Management, a high-profile Sydney-based hedge fund which invests with an ethical focus. Chad is one of the brightest and most passionate investors I've come across. Chad received top grades at school, spent time at some of the world's best investment firms, and now co-leads a team of motivated professionals. But Chad's story isn't all roses. This is an episode I'll be listening to again and again through time, because it includes so many profound ideas about money and investing. If you're new to the world of investing in hedge funds, you can visit the Rask Finance website where we've created a free short video series addressing some issues discussed in this and future episodes. Putting aside a few minutes to understand the key terms will mean you get a lot more from this episode. Please enjoy this conversation with Chad Slater, co-founder of Morphic Asset Management. Chad, thanks for joining me on the show.
No, thank you.
Where we start the show is we go back and we talk about you as a youngster and how you became intertwined in the financial world. So I'm interested to know where you grew up and what ignited that passion for finance and investing.
So I grew up in a country called Papua New Guinea, which some of your listeners may be aware of. An odd choice it would seem. My father was living in New Zealand in 1984, and for any of your listeners who aware of the economies of Australia and New Zealand in the early 1980s, they weren't going very well. Mm-hmm. And he saw an ad in the paper calling for someone who ran supermarkets to move to the highlands of Papua New Guinea. In one of his more harebrained moments, he decided to shift his whole family to the highlands of Papua New Guinea. And it got off to an excellent start. He got arrested in the first 24 hours driving without a license and failing to pay the correct bribe.
Oh, wow.
So that's where I grew up, and sort of that's where my family was. And my parents ran a supermarket up there. And your question was sort of what ignited your passion for business and investing. I suppose it was always there. And that when your dad runs a supermarket and your mum works there as well, and I used to go in every day and help the till.
Yep.
So it's like a 10-year-old, you'd go in and you'd do the end of day accounts.
Yep.
You'd go on the banking run with two armed security guards so you didn't get robbed. You'd offload the trucks, me not physically, but you'd count it. You'd do a stock check with your parents on the weekends. It's sort of part of your life. It's just who you are.
Yeah, well, so you were, how old were you at this time when you were working the store?
So I started sort of helping out when I was 10 or 11 around the store.
Yeah, right.
I was always fairly numerate, and my dad was originally an accountant, and my mum also did the books as well, so I suppose that's where it came from, like your parents.
Yeah.
So you just do the end of day accounts on tills and bank runs. Started doing it when you're 13, 14, 15, a bit more, but yeah, I started about when I was 11.
You get that appreciation for money and business pretty early in life by the sounds of it.
Yeah, I think it's an appreciation for understanding, like, that people, you have to earn this and this comes through, and what it means to, I first learned about margins and markups. It was fairly straightforward back then. It's the equivalent of, say, Woolies or Metcash.
Yep.
And they used to just mark double the price.
Yeah, well, simple strategy.
That's a fairly simple strategy up there then. And profit margins and, you know, understanding what the business is doing. So it's hard to intertwine where it comes from, because when it's all your family's ever done,
it's sort of
hard to say where it starts.
But so when did you, so you moved on to high school, were you still studying over there, or did you come to Australia for that? Or
yes, I went to boarding school in Queensland.
Yep.
It's quite kind. Whilst Papua New Guinea is an amazing place, its education system of high school is fairly poor. That said, the primary schools then were excellent. They had what were called international schools. So anyone there who's lived as an expatriate in Singapore or Hong Kong, there were a lot of international schools still around. Fellow expats and you'd say some of the wealthier locals would go there. But then once you go to high school, you move on. I went down to Brisbane there.
Yep.
And we'd fly home four times a year. Hmm. It was quite difficult for me.
I was going to say, how'd you find that? That would have been...
Yeah, so I was an 11-year-old. Yeah, I was an 11-year-old going to boarding school, 2,000 kilometres from home, and you get to see your parents four times a year.
Yeah.
So it was a pretty big move for my family and that. But you're probably guessing by this point the 3 years that they went up there for had become a bit longer. My parents ended up staying up there 20 years in the end.
Oh, right.
Okay. And you saw a lot of changes in the country in that time.
Yeah. Have you been back since?
I proposed to my wife up there, actually.
Oh, nice.
For your listeners, Papua New Guinea is a place that can't really be understood till you go there.
Right.
I think it's a phenomenal place. 700 of the world's languages are spoken in Papua New Guinea.
Huh.
There's only 2,800 languages in the whole world.
Oh, wow.
There
you go.
It's one of the most diverse, incredible places. Unfortunately, it's a very sad, poor country in other ways, but the people are incredible. They love you, and then they also murder each other. I proposed to my wife up there. I haven't been back since, but I'm looking at taking one of my sons up there when he gets a little bit older. He's a little bit too young yet to take him up there, but it's an incredible place.
Yeah, great. So I suppose through all of this, your parents are, you know, run the family business. Were you, when you were boarding school, perhaps you were reading books or taking accounting or, you ended up at UQ, if I'm not mistaken, and you studied and did really well, economics, commerce. What pushed you down that road?
Yeah, so obviously accounting was part of my life. So once I got to high school, I took an accounting subject and came second on ducks in 1 year of the clock.
Oh, well done.
Simply because it's part of your life. It's fairly straightforward learning journals, cash flows, ledgers and balance sheets. But I didn't love accounting. I always wanted to be a pilot. So to get anywhere in Papua New Guinea, you've got to fly, basically.
Yeah. Okay.
Back in the days, you could sit in the front seat next to the pilot. And I still remember sticking my head out when he's asking, is there a gap in the clouds that we can land through? And then on the sadder sides, like some of our friends' parents were pilots, died, crashed up there. That was what interested me, the maths. Yep. So I was doing physics and that side of things. Also, I did accounting, I didn't love it. And I was sort of grappling as I got towards the end of high school, like what to do. Mm. I tried to become a Air Force pilot, but I was too young, I was 16.
Huh.
So I finished high school when I was 16.
Yep.
Yes, quite young. So I was fortunate enough to have done okay.
Yep.
By this point, I decided to take finance and that at uni, doing accounting, not completely enamored in it. Started meeting people who were doing the course there as well. I'm like, I heard of these things called investment banking. Funds management. Which in Papua New Guinea, there's not really, there was accounting and running businesses, but the actual concept that you could professionally manage money without running a business, I wasn't really aware of probably until I got to university. Mm. So I did that, and then I also did some more math side of things and moved into economics and that as well. And then I met some friends who, I don't know if you've worked for Forager and Steve Johnson's team there.
Mm. Yep.
One of my good friends, him and Steve worked at the Intelligent Investor.
Yeah.
Together.
Yeah.
And he got me into investing, basically. It was where I brought together my background in accounting and finance and that, and we started looking at some stocks.
Mm.
And then he went on to write for the Intelligent Investor, and Steve went on to run Forager.
Mm.
And we started trading, we did a little meetup and things like that, and investing in a few managed funds, Colonial First State in the late 1990s, and bought a few stocks. So that's sort of where it started to come together at that point.
Yeah, I think it's great when you can pair up with someone like that, who shares the passion, and it's great. It led you down this path, and yeah, what a wonderful decision that was.
Yeah, and look, Tim Searles is the guy's name. What I respect about Tim, amongst many other things, is, and he was one of the best man at my wedding, was that he is a more Buffett style investor. And we can talk a little more about investing as we go on, but he can respect other people's investing styles. And I think one of the problems in investing is everyone thinks they're right.
Mm, yep.
When really there's all shades of right.
Mm-hmm.
And so him and I agree on a few things and what we like in companies, but we disagree on a few things. But we, funnily enough, we both started as value investors, call us cheapskates, to a more quality approach. And you learn each other's sort of styles and that as well. And I think it's very important to have someone else to learn from a little bit when you're younger.
Yeah, I think that's great too, that you're not identical, you're not you know, replications of each other. You can probably learn from each other, even if you don't agree. It's a great way to prove out a thesis as well.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah. So let's fast forward a little bit. You've graduated from uni. You've done very well. But then you take a job at Treasury in Canberra.
That's
is right, that right?
Yeah, in Canberra. So in the late 1990s, some of your listeners may be aware, but unemployment was about 8%. So a boy from Queensland, a boarding school, I was just trying to get whatever job you can get. Let's just be frank about this. I wanted to work in funds management, but there was only two firms that hired externally for buy-side roles, BT and Colonial. Mm. I put my name forward for BT and got rejected in the first round.
Okay.
So I actually rang a friend of a friend and said, who was working there at BT Funds Management. BT's the breeding ground of Kerr Neilson, Paul Moore. Right. A lot of the great fund managers of Australia came out of BT in the 1990s. I said, if this is where I want to go and I didn't get in, what's my best chance of trying to get in there another way? And I said, I've got a role at Deloitte, so I can work for an accounting firm. Or Treasury said, you should take Treasury. Hmm. He goes, you'll get to learn how policy's made, work in the economic side of things, and that macroeconomics will ultimately help make you a better investor rather than just think of it from an accounting per se. And to be honest, it's some of the wisest words I've ever received and helped set me on this path. So I took the role, moved down to Canberra, and it was a fascinating year. I worked for Peter Costello doing policy. So it was after 9/11, and so I was working on defence after 9/11, and the policy we would work on is every division, whether it be health, defence, proposes to spend more money, yet the ministers don't really know that much about what they're being asked to approve. So you work as like a firebreak between the department, who always wants to spend more money, and the ministers who want to spend less money, usually, providing them advice on those sort of things. Also met who's now wife there at the time.
Nice.
So a lot of people say, I can't stand Canberra. And I actually loved my time in Canberra.
You did?
Yeah. Oh, look, there's about 3,000 graduates move there each year. So defence, health, PM&C, all the big departments, all getting paid relatively well, living in a relatively small town, going out, like, it's a great time. I don't know if I'd live in Canberra for forever, but I definitely don't regret my time there.
It's a nice city, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very convenient to get around, and it's only 2.5 hours to Sydney. And some friends we're seeing in Paris who are still diplomats, we met from there. It adds, in life, I think, have a diverse group of friends will make you a better person.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so let's now jump to where you did get a role at BT, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
It wasn't too long.
What happened was I decided that I still wanted this role at BT, so I put in for the graduate program for a second year in a row.
Okay.
This time around, I made it past the first round. I got to the second round. Got rejected at the second round this time around.
Oh.
And so I called the HR lady up and said, look, can you just give me some feedback as to why you didn't make it for the final rounds? And they gave me some answers. And I said, I look forward to seeing you next year. She goes, what are you talking about? She goes, this is a graduate role. I said, yeah, I'll be applying again next year. She goes, wow, you really want this. Look, I suppose we can slot you in for another one-on-one interview. And that was basically the beginning of my professional career.
Wow.
A little bit of luck and doggedness, I think, coming together. They flew me up and I had a one-on-one with one of the portfolio managers and we ended up talking for hours on stocks. And my very first, and he asked what my learning experience was, and I was still not working as a professional investor. And I'd bought a company called Melbourne IT.
Oh, wonderful.
Tim, who I mentioned earlier, we had done the whole Buffett analysis. You know, it's a quality business, had a large moat, except it was overpriced. And we did the whole, let's buy when there's blood on streets.
Mm-hmm.
And we did in 2000. And then the stock lost 80% of the value. And then I had to wait 4 years for it to turn around. And I was saying to the portfolio manager at the time, he goes, what was your lesson? And I said, well, don't catch falling knives.
Mm-hmm.
And that helped influence me there. And then, so I took the role at BT. They put me in the grad program. I was just very lucky, to be honest. I thought I could do the job, but at the end of the day, I think 2,000 people interviewed for 5 roles. There's a fair bit of luck involved. I got put in Japanese equities covering all refining stocks. And then BT got sold barely 9 months later. And then I'm like, oh, no, here we go again. I'm not investing anymore. So I went to Paul Biddle, who works for Celeste, a small cap Aussie manager here now. And I said, mate, I've got a 3-month contract they've got to pay out, but I'll work for free and just that will fund my. And he goes to the head of equities then, do you mind if this grad joins us for a few months? All the other grads were getting their pink slips and being sent home. And then they said, oh, look, we're going to rotate you out of here. And I begged not to be rotated out. The head of equities then fought HR on my behalf. And I survived a second time. And then Crispin Murray, who's now head of equities at BTR, or now Pendle here, came on board and said, oh, look, if anyone wants the job that much, we'll keep you on. So a fair bit of luck and good fortune to get me where I am, but I'd also say some persistence.
Yeah, well, they say what's the other difference between failure and success is persistence, right? So is, you know, we would be creeping up to this time where you took a secondment overseas, is that right?
Yeah, so then I worked doing Aussie equities for 2 years, covering stocks you all know, like Woolworths, Coles, was Coles then, about to be Coles. It's funny how not much actually changes, and it's about to come back on the market. Coca-Cola and Qantas and these businesses as a young grad. The thing that was stuck in my mind was Crispin was a young PM then, and he's willing to give us a go. So even though we're in our early 20s, if he thought we knew what we were talking about, he's willing to back us. And that gives you a young person a lot of confidence that their PM is going to back them. He then came to me 2 years in and said, oh, look, we've been offered these roles where we can second people to the US. Would you be interested in taking one of these? I'm like, oh, this would be great. Do some more national equities. And I moved to Boston. I lived over in Boston. Became a Red Sox supporter who are now playing in the Major League Baseball today. Actually, in the American League Series.
Oh, great.
And a bit of a tragic supporter. Yeah, they hadn't won until 04, the year I was there.
Oh, right.
And
caught on.
it was a huge year for them. And I was very nervous, and because I'd been told in advance that they only hired Harvard and MIT graduates. Boston can be a bit intellectually arrogant. Well, look, had some of the best universities in the world there. I'm like, oh my gosh, how am I going to compete against? I'm just from Queensland. They don't even know where Queensland is. Most of them thinks Australia have Croc Dundee. And for me, it was, I think, another defining moment in your career. And it turned out that Australian education system's not that bad.
Oh, good to know.
That we actually do learn as much, if not more, than these guys and girls over there. And the second thing is, it also gives you some confidence in yourself. Like, to know that if you can compete against them, well, hell, I can compete against anyone. So I covered European beverages, looked after companies like Heineken and that. They had about $400 billion of assets when I was over there. So I got to work with all the American teams over there. And that just helps round out your experience with different people in different sectors.
Yeah, well, you've been in Oceania in Australia, then you go to the US and you're investing abroad again from there. That's, well-rounded experience, no doubt. Okay, so then you've come back to Australia, is that right?
Yeah, so I came back. They offered me a role. I said that would be the wrong thing to do, would be to take that, given my firm had paid for. But I did say to Crispin when I got back, I'll give you 2 years return of service. As in, but I'd like to go again. But I owe you 2 years. It's the right thing to do. You did the right thing by me. And that came up at the end of 06, beginning of 07. Because remember, I went there in 04 to the start of 05. I resigned and then went and lived in South America.
What, were you working or just...
Just lived there. Took a sabbatical, and that was another great experience in one's life.
Where did you live?
Lived in Buenos Aires.
Oh, nice.
And just spent some time off. I think, you know, if you can, sabbaticals or gap years or things are very good for you as a person, just to see how other people think. Because if we switch back to markets, when you're trading against someone, it's very important to understand, why are they selling when I'm buying? So you need to think how other people think, or try to understand what someone else is doing. And then only then can you really disagree with them. I know what you're doing, and I know why you're doing it. You can't always know this, obviously, but you need to have an attempt at understanding what the other person is doing. Otherwise, you run the risk that you're the dummy in the trade, that you're the idiot. And until you can understand why you're not the idiot, well, you should assume you're the idiot. So that was good. Lived there, and then up sticks and interviewed in London, New York, and Paris for a few different hedge funds. I decided by this point that my skill set of economics and finance and analysis better suited the hedge fund industry than just pure long onlys. Stan Druckenmiller, some people may recall, worked with George Soros. He had a firm called Duquesne in New York, who I interviewed with over there. They had a couple of Aussies working over there. Carmignac Estation, which is a large quasi-hedge fund. They have about $80 billion of assets in Paris now. They have four Australians working there, all XBT people.
Small world.
Yeah, and then Hugh Sloan for Sloan Robson, a long-short hedge fund in London. And ended up taking this Hunter Hall role, because, funny thing in life, it loops back, the person who gave me the advice to go to Treasury to end up working at Hunter Hall in London.
Oh, right.
And he said, look, I'd really like you to come join us. And I knew I liked him, and yeah, James McDonald, who went on to become Deputy CIO of Hunter Hall and mm-hmm. works at Pengana now. So I joined there, and that was in moving into a PM role. So I got my first capital to be allocated, mm-hmm. and I was allocated capital, like I think I got about $100 million to run inside Hunter Hall at the sprightly age of 30.
I was going to say, how old were you? Yeah.
I was a young PM, and that was September 2007.
Perfect
and, from that point onwards, I think it went downhill. I think they joked in the office that as soon as I joined, the bear market began.
That'd be right.
So, yeah, it was an interesting time to be in London.
Yeah, but I've read before that you actually did quite well, all things considered, throughout the GFC.
Yeah, look, again, luck and time. You'd always like to claim that it's all your own brilliance. Mm-hmm. And look, I clearly did some things okay. It helped that I didn't have entrenched positions in the firm. Mm-hmm. So one hard thing about investing is when you have to sell an idea to your own firm, you start to believe very deeply mm-hmm. in the idea. And ideas that you believe deeply in are difficult to divorce yourself from. Mm-hmm. The less deeply you're enmeshed in an idea, the easier it is to divorce. But if you're not enmeshed in an idea, you've got no conviction to hold it. Mm-hmm. So like everything, investing is a two-edged sword. You need both sides, and trying to find the right balance is difficult. So I had no built-in positions, which helped me compared to the other people. Mm-hmm. But I also had learned from a number of people in different things called stop losses,
yep.
which are not traditionally used in long-only firms. Mm-hmm. So as I ended a few positions, I was stopped out. And as the GFC got worse and worse, my cash balance just kept increasing through time. Mm-hmm. So as a result, like my cash pool that I was running for the firm actually fell less than 10 or 15%. Mm-hmm. Simply because when you stick it in cash, it's very difficult to lose too much money.
Yeah.
It was a pretty horrendous time in London. I don't think Australians appreciate how bad it actually was here, over there compared to here. At least half my friends lost their jobs.
Right.
So they arrived, because they're Australians, usually work in London. First person you cut's the easiest one to cut.
Yeah, he's not going to be here for long. Let's get rid of him now.
He's got no family. We'll send him home to Australia.
Yep.
There was talk at one point amongst people the banks would run. There was a run on Northern Rock. Banks would run out of money. Mm-hmm. Food would be on no Tesco shelves. Mm-hmm. So it was a very quick decline from oligarchs and Ferraris at the start of 07 to no food on the shelves by the middle of 08. But the hard thing, I think, is in investing, and this relates to the GFC, is a lot of investors are broken clocks. Mm. That is, a clock that doesn't work right twice a day. Mm-hmm. As if I was making money in the bear market, was how, when do I get back to being invested? Mm. That was the difficult question I grappled with. At some point, assuming we didn't end up, scratching in the cave and the civilization didn't exist, and that was the hard thing, trying to find when to get bullish. And I got it wrong in October. Right. I bought too early.
Yeah.
Got stopped back out. Good thing about stop losses is they take. And then we had to go in June the following year of 09. So I was about 4 months too late.
Right.
But that was the thing. We got back to being invested in Ousley, Jack and myself, because he's running about $500 million. I was running about $100 million at that point.
This is your co-founder.
Yep.
Yep.
And that's the difficult part, is to know when you should go from one to the other. Mm. So obviously we'll talk later, but the difficult part is now when to go from being invested to not being invested in the future.
Yeah.
It's a very, very tricky part.
So would you say that one of the key learnings from that experience was, I suppose, using stop losses, such a simple thing?
Oh.
Knowing when to walk away or just setting it.
Yes, well, I think absolutely. If your listeners can take one thing out of it, is a simple process can trump the most convoluted, deeply researched anything you want in the world. And if you stick to your rules, it will serve you well. Because we have a saying here, and is that how do you know when you're wrong and when you're early? Mm. They look the same.
Yep.
You've lost money. You can only ever know in hindsight after the fact which one was which. Mm. So if your stock's gone down 30 or 40%, are you early or wrong? Mm. Now, nearly everyone, when they're down 30%, thinks they're early.
Mm. They do.
Only when they lose 60 or 70% do they realise they're wrong.
Mm. And that's one of the things, right, about stop losses is it doesn't mean that you stop following the business. You can keep following it.
Yes.
Yeah, there's nothing to say that. You just don't have any skin in the game while it's falling.
And we have a saying here as well, knowledge doesn't die.
Yep. Yep.
Great. Like, is it?
Yep.
It's still there. And we have a cooling off period that we've implemented here. Is I'm yet to see someone get stopped out of a stock basically and go, you know what? That was a really dumb idea that I bought. Mm. Nearly always, they're adamant that it's just going to turn around tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Like a gambler with his last round of cash, throwing it there. But what the easy bit's getting stopped out in hindsight. Yeah. The hard bit is, again, coming, when do you go back in? Mm. Like when is it right time to re-enter this position? Mm. So the difficult thing we say is, there's a great blog called Epsilon Theory, mm-hmm. And they wrote a piece called Always Go to a Funeral.
Okay.
Now talking about life, that funerals are a very important way of commemorating a life.
Mm-hmm.
But you can have funerals can be a sad occasion, or they can also be a happy occasion in some respects. Mm-hmm. Think of a drunken eulogy, Irish sort of celebration wake.
Yep.
So when you get stopped out or you sell a stock, you can be selling a stock for a profit as well.
Mm.
You should write up, what did you learn and when would you go back?
Mm.
So if you've made 40% or 50% or doubled your money and you think it's overvalued, put a price target down, set it in ComSec or whoever you're using, and if it goes back there, revisit the idea.
Mm.
And conversely, if it's gone down but then comes back up a little bit and things are looking okay, revisit the idea.
Mm.
We've got lots of sayings here. They're good little mental shortcuts to remember things. Don't have strongly held views. Have loosely held views, but that you're happy to change.
Mm.
Like right. that is in strongly held views are difficult to separate you from.
Yeah, as you said earlier. Okay, well, we're kind of getting there anyway, but let's jump into the business today. Why you decided to start Morphic, and was it just the two of you in the beginning, you and Jack? Or
so the idea was originally two of us. So Jack was deputy CIO at Hunter Hall, mm-hmm. and my background in economics, I was in charge of macroeconomics and the hedging book for the portfolio. A couple of $1 billion of portfolio had to be hedged out, FX. And with Jack as deputy CIO, and also in our quasi-senior roles and that, we had a lot of interaction about what do we do on this, what do we do on that.
Mm.
And he approached me in late 2011 and said, look, I'm 55. Mm. I think we can do some things different to what we do here. I think we can do some things that we do well, but, this is my opportunity to have a go. And I'm like, well, I've got some ideas too. Because stop losses weren't really official policy at Hunter Hall, for example. They're not official policy at most long-only firms.
Yeah.
But we knew if we were going to be more like that, we needed to hire someone that had more of a hedge fund background. And we thought long shorts become more important going forward.
Mm-hmm.
The industry dynamics are changing, as we'll talk if you want about that, but long-only investing is becoming a lower-fee business and people want more pure, what we call pure alpha.
Yep.
And long short gives you more pure alpha.
Mm.
But we had no experience.
I was going to say, were you short? So you weren't shorting up until?
No, it was cash only. Hunter Hall was a long-only firm. Yep.
Okay, not even in your personal account, nothing?
No. A little bit in my personal account previously, but that was an experience. Again, there's some experiences there.
Okay.
Shorting is a very different skill set,
mm.
And I learned that the hard way personally as well. So we took those insights into the investment firm. We hired Jeff Wood, our head of macro and risk, probably the best hire I've ever made in my life.
Right.
Jeff is a phenomenal individual.
Mm.
He was working at a global macro firm called GTS.
Mm-hmm.
Global macro is where you use foreign exchange and rates and that to say whether Thailand might be a good investment or Korea is going up or Korea is going down. You're not choosing stocks, you're choosing countries, basically. And that skill set we thought in the hedge fund background would suit well. We knew how to pick stocks. We think we know how to pick stocks.
Mm.
It's the other part that we were short of skills.
Yep.
And the good part, one of the big lesson in investing is know what you don't know. No one can be everything.
Yep, that's great.
And if you have a fair idea of what you can't do, you can substitute other people for that. You don't need to try and become that person.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we haven't really talked about Buffett, and I'm not really a Buffett-style investor, but I've got a lot of respect for what him and Munger have achieved. Munger's greatest quote, and I think my friend Tim is adamant that Munger's actually the brains behind the two of them, is your circle of competency.
Mm-hmm.
You might have had other investors talk about it.
Yep.
Circle of competence is know what you can and can't do. And Munger's believes his great success is they know what their circle of competency is.
Mm.
For your listeners, understand what you can do and what you can't do. And one of the hardest things is you're always looking for new ideas. We can talk about that in a sec. But knowing when not to stray, or basically you should never stray outside your circle of competency, but knowing what your circle of competency is will help you be a better investor. So that's why we've got Jeff on board, the three of us. And then we've added some analysts over time. James, our head of research, so there's now 11 of us.
Mm. It seems like a great mix of skill sets. And just on your point about circle of competence, I think a good analogy is like if you have the circle, you imagine the circle, and then you overlay them, but they're slightly shifted in different, you know, angles, and you can really pad out that circle of competence or widen it a little bit, but not too far that you're coming up with the wrong ideas. That's great. So how did you fund the business? How did you, you know, it's a pretty bold move to have a pretty good job and just go out and go on your own.
Yes, it's the we promised our staff the chance of some success, highly unlikely. You'll be underpaid. It wasn't a very good sales pitch, but got a few. Look, I actually meet with probably someone once every couple of months who gets asked, I'm thinking about doing this. Mm-hmm. And I say to them, don't do it.
Right.
My advice is, because it's a very unsatisfying and unrewarding path in many respects. You're giving up. So people in the industry are fairly well paid.
Yep.
Some may even argue overpaid. Mm-hmm. They're definitely not underpaid. Mm-hmm. You're giving away, you're risking a lot. So you really truly need to believe that you can do something different. Because the world's got plenty of fund managers. Mm. But if you can do something different, we felt we had something to offer the funds management world. Whether our clients believe that or not, it's another matter. But we think we've got enough clients who believe it. So we were funded by some clients from Hunter Hall, mm-hmm. Who had a large amount of money at Hunter Hall, and they would transfer some money over to start it. And we're also funded by some high net worths for the working capital cost of the business, okay. Like paying office rent,
yep.
Bloomberg terminals, et cetera, mm-hmm. The cost of running a business. Mm-hmm. And they took a stake in the business in return for that.
Oh, right. Okay. And they're still on today?
So most of them sold out to Westpac in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
So Westpac owned or owns a third of us. But that has just been sold in the last week to a new owner.
Okay.
So funnily enough, back to BT, Rob Coombe, who used to be my boss at BT.
Oh, right.
Actually now owns the business called Ascalon, which has all the stakes in their boutiques.
Mm-hmm.
Don't burn your bridges because you never know when you need to use them again.
That's proof in the pudding. Okay, so from a high levels perspective, running long short, can you explain to us, I suppose, for some listeners who may not be acutely aware the mechanics of shorting, potentially for my benefit as well, how you approach that shorting and as well as the long side, what you're looking for from a high level?
Okay, so my first piece of advice to listeners is shorting, don't do it.
Yep.
One of the oddities of shorting is shorting by itself is very risky.
Mm.
But when shorting is added to a long portfolio, it reduces the overall risk of the portfolio. Mm. So it's this paradox,
mm-hmm.
that shorting makes for a lower risk portfolio, but shorting by itself is quite risky. Mm. So you need a lot of rules and structure around it. And we wrote a piece for our investors on our website about introduction to shorting, which hopefully can give a better and fuller explanation than this. Think of it this way. The rough rule of thumb in investing is you should make more out of your winners than you lose in your losers. And if you do that often enough, you make money. Mm-hmm. That's like 101 of investing.
Yep.
If you do nothing, if you put $100 into two stocks and your winner goes to $200 and your loser goes to $50, you now have four times as much money in your winning calls than you do in your losing call. Mm-hmm. Your portfolio is naturally rebalanced towards having more money in winning calls.
Mm-hmm.
So you're doing a good behavioral thing by being lazy.
Mm-hmm.
So like that's a good
outcome.
That's a
great way to put it.
Yeah, now think of it as you put $100 into shorting a stock, or two stocks. One of them, the successful short, goes to 50. The unsuccessful short goes to 200.
Mm-hmm.
You now have four times as much money in your unsuccessful short. So if you keep going like this, your unsuccessful short will be $400 in a year's time, and the other one will be 200. So you add the 80 you made there plus the 300 you lost there, and you'll be down on it. So even though you did nothing wrong,
mm-hmm.
you got them both right, and they both moved in the same percentages. So the problem with shorting is it's a high-touch thing. You can't leave shorts alone. And this, I think, is a role for professionals, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah.
Either that or if you're going to commit to it, it's a job.
Yeah, and I agree wholeheartedly with you.
Whereas I think long-term investing can actually be done quasi. So patience is a good skill.
Mm.
And working full-time can be bad for patience because there's an expectation mm-hmm. that you come to work every day and do something.
Mm.
Output needs to be produced. What are you producing? I often say, you know, going to the beach for a month for your staff might actually be the best thing for them.
Mm.
So for your listeners, patience is a great advantage that they have over the professionals.
Mm.
Now, professionals have other advantages, but they should use that. Patience will not serve you well in shorting.
I'm interested, actually, while we're on the topic, to talk about what you think is the edge that you have here at Morphic.
A question you should always ask a portfolio manager, and one that can never really be quantified. Mm. What I think our edge is you talked about a few circles of competency. Mm-hmm. We bring together a couple of circles that don't often overlap. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is the industry is split into silos. Think of grain silos. They're side by side. They contain the same grain. Mm-hmm. They don't interact with each other. Think of an equity bottom-up stock picker, whether it be someone from Perpetual, PM Capital, Cairn Hills. They say, we choose great stocks, but we don't really think about the macro. And then so that's all they do. Mm-hmm. Then you think of someone, or Magellan's a better example, they don't care, global macro firm. We choose countries, but we don't do stocks. Mm-hmm. What do you think drives the earnings at the aggregate of all the companies? Macro does. Mm-hmm. I do not believe that you can have a view on stocks and not actually have an understanding of macro. But most people, so even JB Hi-Fi, Aussie retail sales will be a big determinant, you know, or Woolworths, ultimately, of where they go. Now, there is market share shifts that can change, but the biggest, or BHP, mm-hmm. Chinese growth is going to be the biggest determinant. Like, how can you not have views on these things? Mm. But you're probably the least qualified person as a stock picker to have that view. Mm. But the macro person shouldn't have a view on a stock because they don't know. Like, so we've tried to bring two silos together, but how you bring them together is they're very different personalities, they're different types of people, and to mesh them into a portfolio. And our ideal stock is where James, my head of research, is going, you know, I love this company in Japan. It's cheap, it's growing, everything about it's good. And Jeff, my head of macro, goes, you know, the macroeconomic outlook for Japan's excellent at the moment. I have a double tick.
Yep.
My two sides, whether they like it or not, are agreeing on the same thing. Mm-hmm. So I think our edge is that we bring these things together into an enmeshed process that's quite rare.
Mm. I should add that Jeff's got some great stuff on your website as well, some high-level stuff that anyone can access and just have a read. It's really good stuff. That's great. It's a really succinct answer, and I like the analogy. Okay, so not only are you long short, you've also got an ethical focus. Ethics can be quite controversial at times. Can you explain how you perceive the role of ethics in and its role, I suppose, in business? And one angle that I'm particularly keen to understand is how you can use that to benefit investing world or businesses themselves.
Yeah, so obviously we worked at Hunter Hall, which was Australia's leading ethical investor, global equities ethical investor. Mm. So we had a lot of experience working in the space. When we first left, we didn't formally adopt the phrase. We thought moving long short was a big enough move. Yep. But you know, you are a product of where you live and what you've done. Mm. And just in the same way, I'm a product of Hunter Hall, which is we never bought any tobacco stocks when we started here. We've never really owned any alcohol stocks. It's just not. So it was always there, but we didn't brand. And then we started going with the branding and the LIC and that. And I think the really key thing is there's two parts. There's your values, and then there's value. Hmm. Okay, your values are your beliefs. So if you're of Catholic faith, mm-hmm. That has certain belief systems associated with it. Mm-hmm. So the most obvious ones are your religion. Your values are your values. Who am I to tell you who your values are, as long as they're legal? Yep. Yep. And it doesn't have to be religion. It can also be things like the RSPCA. I do know of an ethical fund run for RSPCA. Well, you can guess what their values mm-hmm. are. Yep. Animal testing is the biggest thing they care about. Mm-hmm. And I think often it's lost between your values and the value that's added from doing ethically investing. And the values are largely determined by what my clients want. Mm-hmm. I happen to share their values largely. Mm-hmm. And they are what you call your negative screens. Mm-hmm. So they're things that we say to our clients, we won't own these. But value is about buying businesses that do the right thing. Mm-hmm. So I think that we can make more money out of companies that aren't pricks. Mm-hmm. And Buffett is not really an ethical investor. He owns Coca-Cola. A lot of people consider Coca-Cola unethical. Mm-hmm. But quality management, it turns out, if you treat your staff well and treat your customers well and you have a culture of openness and not bigotry and so on, those businesses actually perform better. Mm. That's value. That's adding value to your clients rather than their values. So we try to mesh, again, the two things together, is that we don't own coal companies, for example. Our clients don't want us to own those. Now, that's not passing judgment on it. That's their choice.
Yep.
They don't have to. As in, we feel of this 8,000 remaining stocks in the world, there's plenty of choice mm-hmm. in those 8,000 for us to do things that don't betray their beliefs. I think that gets lost by a lot of people. I grew up in Queensland, as we talked about. Quite a few mining engineers mm-hmm. and my cohort of friends who are happy after a few beers to tell me, well, mate, I work in a coal mine. How do you live with yourself? And I'm like, because that's what they want. It's like turning up in a restaurant and someone saying, I want this salad served this way. You're the restaurateur. Whether you like the salad served that way or not, it's not really... Now, I don't have a problem with their values, by the way.
Yep.
I think cluster ammunition and nuclear are not particularly nice things to do, and I'm happy not to own them.
Yep.
So we then try to incorporate what we do in ESG audit, which is ESG stands for environmental, social, and governance. So mm-hmm. it's more of a holistic approach than just what you'd call ethical. And you're trying to find and tease out, is this company really doing what they say?
Mm.
So we look for board diversity. Why does board diversity matter? This question I think should be asked. It matters because teams with diverse people make better decisions than individuals. There's a book called Super Forecasters.
Mm-hmm.
I strongly recommend your mm-hmm. listeners to read it if they haven't already read it. And it shows how teams trump people.
Mm.
So teams that reach better decisions than individuals do. Diverse teams reach better decisions than homogeneous teams, monoculture teams. So, and adding females has been shown the biggest single way to increase cognitive diversity in a team. So it just is what it is. Mm. It's not my belief. It's in, they're your beliefs you might want to have that it'd be good to have more females. It simply is that they make better returns from doing it this way. Through to things such as zero-class shares. Mm-hmm. Facebook, for example, if your clients along that, you don't have the same voting rights as Mark Zuckerberg. Now, you may be happy with that, but I think that's personally an orange flag. Because why? Because having worked through the GFC, when things go bad, they'll look after number one, and you're not number one.
Yeah,
so these are how we incorporate it into understanding. Let's not get caught when the tide goes out with people who don't share our beliefs and then don't put us first, don't put shareholders first. These are some of the ways that we look for that.
Okay, can I just throw a hypothetical at you? Let's say a company like Woolworths, when we're recording this, it's got a liquor business. Would that pass or that fail that filter?
So how we go through the values filter is we can't own alcohol stocks.
Yep.
So clearly Diageo is fairly straightforward, or a liquor supplier. Then we have so that's the black area.
Yep.
Then you have the grey area. And Woolworths is classic grey area. We have a percentage of revenue test.
Okay.
And we're set at 20% of revenue.
Right.
And Woolworths will be through that because it also distributes tobacco.
Yep.
So there are a number of businesses that will not, whose sole business is not. And look, all the time we have this discussion. Clients, I always get asked, well, what about this one? Or what about this one? Generally, the view is clients just want to know that you're trying to do the right thing. And we'll have debates with our clients and say, this is why we felt this. We were along a company that made energy drinks.
Mm.
Now, energy drinks are not illegal.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the main part of their business. It's not in our negative screens.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing, it's not an unethical thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But some clients don't agree with that. We said all those things, plus it's less than 10% of the business. We think it's a good investment.
Mm.
Our clients will, and usually the client will debate it out. And if they don't agree, they don't agree. But the clients want to know there's a process.
Mm.
That your values, or their values, because that's who I'm investing on behalf of, have been correctly reflected in the portfolio.
That seems reasonable. Another point of this is I read a piece, and I'll link to it in the show notes, where you were quoted in the AFR talking about AMP, the embattled financial services business that had a few things recently come out about it that weren't so good from a governance perspective. Where do you stand on investors being more proactive or active when it comes to these issues?
Oh, I think we have a fairly staunch stance on this, and this is becoming more popular overseas, and I'd like to see more of it in Australia. It's called engagement or active ownership. In a world where there's more passive money, passive by its very definition doesn't have a say on anything because the management knows what's the passive manager going to do if they don't like it. What they can do, sell your shares? No, they can't.
Mm.
They have to own your shares. So you can completely disregard their views. I think the onus is actually going up on active equity managers to be more engaged and to be vocal.
Mm.
Now, the reason why I I came back to Australia from London. Australia's a bit of a cozy shop. That most CEOs went to school with the investors, mm-hmm. and their friends and wives know each other, and it's an awkward conversation they'd rather not have.
Mm. And what do they get out of it if it doesn't work out for them?
Yeah, and usually you're looking for a job somewhere else. They usually pop up somewhere else inside the industry, and that's one of the things I don't like so much about Australia. Good about things I do like about Australia, but this team's a little bit of an outsiders team. I came back from London. Jess English, James is English, Irene's Greek, Nadim's from Fiji. But we think our primary responsibility is not to whether my wife's friends are unhappy with what she's saying on the TV or I'm saying on TV, is to our shareholders and to our investors. So we try usually to engage quietly, but if it doesn't work out, we don't mind publicising our thoughts, even if that leaves us on the outer. Mm-hmm. And I think our investors should expect more from the industry funds in particular, who don't seem willing to push. Mm. Who do a lot of talk about engagement, and industry funds have done a great job. This is not bad. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of talk about things, but the industry funds are very worried they're going to lose access to management.
Yeah, of course.
Yes, that's my view.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I hear you. Okay, so we've talked about the ethical side. Let's talk more about the process. How do you deal? We've been through one of the filters, which is obviously that ethical filter. Yep. How do you get down from those thousands of companies to a more manageable list?
So we use a series of quant screens and quant models, which you put in parameters mm-hmm. of what you're looking for. There are things called factors, and they're becoming more popular, and your mm-hmm. listeners may hear more about them if they haven't already. Think of factors a little bit as when you eat bread or pasta, to you it's bread or pasta, to your body it's carbohydrates.
Mm-hmm.
Factors are like this secondary thing that exists inside a stock. You think you might be buying Qantas, but you're actually buying a series of factors like carbohydrates and protein. Mm-hmm. And we like the factors of value. So a value is a factor, mm-hmm. So we're value investors. The thing that separates us is we like momentum.
Mm.
Momentum can be thought of as trend investing, mm-hmm. or we like to know things are going up. And why do we like that so much? Because funnily enough, investing is very much about who you are, is the DNA. Some people are optimists. Now, I'm not an optimist. I'm a pragmatist, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Optimists tend to be growth investors. Contrarians, if you say it's white, they want to say it's black. Mm-hmm. Then you say it's black, they'll say it's white.
Mm-hmm.
Are value investors nearly always. Both of them have great strengths. The issue with the growth investor is he hangs around the party too long and the growth stops. And there's a joke in markets that you go up on the escalator and down on the elevator.
Hmm.
And he gives up a lot of his returns. He's hung around too long.
Mm-hmm.
So momentum served him well and he lost it. Value guys' problem is they buy too early.
Hmm.
So what you do, and this is AQR, which is a big US quant funds insight, which is remarkable. They said, why don't we take the best bits of growth investing, which is momentum, and the best bits of value, which is buying cheap stocks, and stick them together and see how it goes. Turns out it works fabulously.
Mm.
It works in every country, in every region, basically, and pretty much over all time periods. Not all time periods, but a lot of time periods.
Okay.
That was one of the insights is that to try and take a more quantitative approach. So we use these things. We get our list down to about 100 names, 200 names. That's more than enough to find 30 stocks out of.
Yeah. So what's your typical holding period?
So again, because we're long-short funds, things are different. You cannot take a long model and flip it to a short model.
Mm.
For all the reasons we talked about, the patient serves you well in the long. So our longs and our shorts have to be thought of separately.
Mm.
So our longs, we can own 2, 3, 4 years. We've only been going 5. But because we use stop losses, you have a shorter time period than you. Because at some point, if I lose a certain amount of money, I'm going to get out of it. You can't have a super long holding period and have a risk-based policy at the same time. They just don't coexist.
Yeah.
But on a shorts, it's 3, 4, 6 months. Shorts are like in, out, in, out. Again, this is why it probably doesn't suit people who aren't working full time. Because think of it, the most you can ever make on a short is 100%.
Mm.
And that would be finding a company that goes to zero. There's not actually that many of them.
Mm.
So realistically, you make 20 to 40%. That's a great outcome on a short.
Mm.
The key is to do that 4 times. Then you've made 160%.
Mm-hmm.
But it requires a lot more management of the position. And also if it goes against you, because it's getting bigger in your portfolio. So what I'm saying is our short holding period is somewhere between 3 to 12 weeks.
Okay.
So
you're looking for catalysts?
Nearly always catalysts.
Yep.
Like, it's pretty hard to have. You need to, because stocks basically go up over time, again, patience serves you well. Mm-hmm. If nothing happens, stocks tend to drift higher. Mm. So you nearly always need a catalyst. Like, you've got to know there's an earnings, a corporate day, a competitor reporting, something. Because stocks just don't just come in one day and decide to go down normally.
Can you give us an example maybe that might emphasise that catalyst, and maybe go with a successful one?
Yeah, go with a successful one. We'll do one that we've been in the press a lot for. Okay. We've been short Platinum Asset Management.
Yep.
And since everyone knows the stock as well, I've got nothing against Kerr Neilson. And this is the other thing about shorting. I think too many people take it personally. Now, in Kerr's case, obviously he should, in that because he's the founder of the business. But if you're the CEO of the business, what we say to people that we're in short their stock, we do try to meet with people we're short. Why would I do this, by the way? We're one of the few hedge funds in the world to do this. Mm. It's because, what if I'm wrong? Mm. What if I'm, like, let's just say I'm completely wrong here. Like, unless you should go and speak with them. Now, I've chatted to people who run long short funds, and they go, oh, look, all they're going to do is feed you lies. I'm like, no, the burden of proof is on me to figure out what's a lie and what's not a lie. Mm. And if you're wrong, you need to figure that out early, because you're going to lose a lot of money if you're wrong. So we always say to them, why should I meet with a shorter? And I say, look, I don't have a problem with you. I have a problem with your share price. Which means if I have a problem with your share price, I have a problem with the other investors, not you. If your share price goes down 30%, we no longer have a problem. Mm. I just think your business is overvalued. And that's not the same as I dislike you. And this is perhaps the economist part of me. I think people get fake very emotional. It's very difficult to pull the two apart. Mm. So in Platinum's case, we thought the business was in outflows. And one thing about funds management is outflows tend to beget more outflows. Mm. So it has what's persistency, it's called. So it means a stock's more likely to go down. Mm-hmm. We knew that they had their AGM coming up, and you normally update coming into an AGM. So we'd built a short position, it rallied against us, and then the company accounts came out, as well as discussing the AGM date. It was clear that they were miles off track, and the stock dropped quite precipitously. And then it became quite public knowledge, because it was in our top 10 holdings, and then Kerr launched a classic counterattack against us, unbeknownst at the time that we'd already covered our short. And so the stock rallies back quite viciously, rallied 40-odd percent, as he announced that he'd do a share buyback, which we then shorted more stock after the rally. And this is the nature of shorting.
Yep.
And then we covered again when it went back down. So it's a bit of a trench warfare. Mm. But Kerr was very good through the whole process.
Like, oh, right.
He was like, we short stocks. So the fact that some people have chosen to short our stocks should not surprise us. Mm. The AGM, he had some irate shareholders. And Kerr's like, if I want to short stocks, I've got to be open to the idea that people might want to short me. Mm. Kerr's a fabulous investor. He worked at BT years ahead of me. People still speak about the time when he was there. He's an amazing investor, incredible investor. And his legacy of building a huge business in Australia will live on for many years, hopefully. But that didn't mean the stock wasn't overvalued.
Yeah. There's that value principle that you spoke of. Speaking of value, a terrific post on the Morphic site was, it asked, is value investing dead? And we've heard the debate a few times, but you made some interesting points, and I think maybe just to frame this conversation, just for listeners who aren't aware, maybe you can explain what we mean by growth versus value stocks.
Yeah, so and it's a very good question for your listeners, because they hear the phrases bandied around. Mm. There's basically three metrics that you use on each side. Price to book. So it's the value on the stock exchange versus what the assets are marked at in the accounts is one metric. So PE can be used, but it's got to be used usually in conjunction with price to book. So value stocks have lowish PBs and PEs. So numbers I might choose might be less than 2x price to book and a PE of less than 15, something along those lines. Growth investors, on the other hand, have relatively high PE. And they're paying high PEs because they believe these businesses are going to grow fast, whether it be Cochlear, CSL, some of the great success stories of Australia. And the other value guys believe the businesses are not as broken as people think they are. Mm-hmm. And so they sort around in the trash, if you want to think of it that way. And the key to a good value investor is to not find trash in the trash. Mm-hmm. Key to a good growth investor is to not overpay for a business that's actually not growing. And again, I'd like just to emphasise for your listeners, there's no right way to make money. Don't feel the need to turn up in Omaha if it's not who you are. Mm. You can't be him. He is who he is. But what you can be is you. You can't be anyone else because they're already taken. And you is a combination of different traits. It will be you getting optimistic on certain days, you wanting to cry or get pessimistic or get angry on certain things and stuff like that. And you need to harness those behaviors for you, the best outcomes for you. And that means doing less of what you do badly, which might be getting angry and buying shares, or conversely selling them on the lows and adjusting to that. And I just wanted to feel I need to add that in there, because if you're listening, that's how you become a better investor. Mm-hmm. Understand who you are. If you can't know yourself, you're never going to win. Mm. And if you try to copy people, you're never going to win either. But you can win by being who you are. And so growth people, some of your listeners will be growth and some will be value. Mm. There's nothing right or wrong. Like, it's just who you are. Where it goes wrong is trying to turn a value investor into a growth investor, or a growth investor into a value investor. Now, the big problem is, in the last 5 years, growth has trumped value. So these high-growing, sexy stocks like Cochlear and that have made investors a lot of money. And the Telstra's a classic value stock, has lost a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And there's a feeling that value is never, ever going to come back because it's now given up the better part of 20 years of performance. So over the long run, why do you make money out of value? If you're buying crappy businesses or poor businesses, why do you make money? Basically, no one wants to be an outlier. No one wants to be the hated guy in the room. So you get paid a premium to be disliked, basically, if you want to think of it that way. And that premium more than rewarded you for the dodginess of some of the stocks. It appears at the moment these stocks are broken. They're just not growing anymore. Mm. So that's why I wrote, is value investing dead? Because Buffett and Graham originally was the classic old school value investors, and that's where Buffett started. Could this 60 or 80 years of value not work anymore? Mm. And the jury's out. I put some opinions in there and about what value might need to adapt. The biggest single conclusion, and it's an open conclusion, mm-hmm. is globalization and the movement to apps, etc., might have actually changed market structures globally. Mm. Where it moves, previously, you never really had one auto company dominating the world, or an auto parts, or whatever. They would, running a company at a certain size becomes too complex and too large. GE, there's a classic one going backwards. Yeah. The complexity, so you don't have what's called in economics, and by the way, this is why economics is so good to help you frame stocks. You don't have what's called economies of scope and scale. You have some economies of scale to a certain size, but there's no economies of scope, which is as you move to different divisions, you can't translate the ideas across all the divisions because the complexity goes up. It appears that Facebook and Netflix, and these are different businesses, because you don't need to build another factory. That selling another ad is cost you nothing, basically. So there appears to be very limitless economies to scale there. And scope seems to be not so much of an issue there, where you buy WhatsApp or Instagram, and it doesn't relate directly to your business, but you're able to feed them in and cross-monetize. Mm. Has this completely changed capitalism? At the moment, it looks like it, but I would be wary of reaching a firm conclusion on that, given you shouldn't bet against 100 years of data.
Yeah, four most dangerous words in investing, right? I think that's a great post, and I'll link to it in the show notes. Your three key takeaways to summarise them were be prepared for a long winter, this is for value investing, be open to adapting, and avoid junk.
Yes, so that was one of the other great insights. Again, I always try to read widely. I advise, read things you don't agree with. One of the biggest problems on the internet now is people read things that they agree with only. So I think my lessons as an investor is I have a group of friends who range from extreme bears to bulls. And most of them don't change. They are who they are. But you've got to figure out when to listen to each one. And so we're reading some people, value investors, who have got a more quantitative approach than us. And their interesting point was that junk, so when I said going through the trash, is that if you junk inside of that, so there's cheap stocks, and there's cheap stocks which are rubbish. You could argue that Telstra looks like a bit like that. I don't have a personal opinion on it, but they're called value traps. You make most of your money by not choosing great value stocks, but by staying away from bad value stocks. So there's the other thing I'd like for your listeners to remember, is that what you don't do is almost as important as what you do do. And very few people focus on what they don't do, as in your choices that you don't invest in can define you more than the choices of what you do invest in. So that's what I meant by stay away from junk.
Yeah, it's a great point. Seeing that we've been talking about Buffett and Munger this whole time, Buffett's rules, don't lose money. That's rule number one. Number two, don't forget rule number one. But another one is a Munger classic is instead of seeking brilliance, just try not to do something dumb.
Yeah.
And that's...
so true.
Yeah.
It is, like, Munger, he's a man for his time. And you read, he was using behavioural insights before Kahneman and Tversky got their Nobel Prize for economics for that he has been way ahead of the curve on all this stuff.
You briefly mentioned the FANG stocks. Do you have a position?
So if we, as a firm, invest in value, they don't have any of the criteria. One could argue Apple is the odd one out in there because Apple is more, it's a manufacturing business.
Yep.
It might pretend it's not, but ultimately outsourcing and manufacturing is still manufacturing.
Mm.
Whereas the other businesses have a more, now Apple's trying to re-engineer, but the answer is no, it's not what we do.
Yep.
Again, circle of competency. I keep coming back to the same thing. Mm. You might even think I'm a Munger-style investor at the end of this. Is what's my edge on US large cap stocks?
Mm.
And your listeners should ask what's their edge as well. Mm. I don't believe I've got one.
Mm.
I think they can be covered by more brilliant people I used to work with in the US who are closer to management, who have better access and have better resources than you'll ever have.
Mm.
So stay away from things you don't have an edge on. Large cap, US, not value. Mm. In a sector that I don't fully understand. No need to be there.
That's a fair point. Okay, so let's talk about then where you are seeing opportunities today. And maybe, you know, Tim, we talked a bit about shorting, where you're seeing some of the risks in the market today.
Yeah, it's a very interesting time to be doing this podcast. Mm. We're either late in the bull market, or if we're already at the end, I don't know. But I feel like I said that a year or two ago, but now it's got a lot more of the characteristics that we're getting towards the end.
Mm.
Now, which may sound obvious, I should go and sell everything. One big problem with that is nearly always the return in the bull market, you make the majority of returns in the last 2 years.
Mm.
You don't actually lose the majority. So being early there is as good as being wrong.
Mm.
So just because you think you're near the end doesn't mean you should sell everything. What it means is you should go stand near the emergency exit. So... what we see is there's this big dispersion between US stocks, which are expensive,
mm-hmm.
and the rest of the world. An area that we happen to love that has value and momentum is Japan.
Mm.
Japan is the forgotten cousin of the world. That people that might go skiing there or visit, it's only 9 hours from Australia, less from Cairns.
Good spot.
Love the place. Awful place to invest. It's been for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Japan's going through fundamental change. One of our sayings for the firm is slogans is change creates opportunity.
Mm.
Now that might sound obvious, of course change does, but a lot of people don't actually look for change. They wait till it happens and then they get caught up trying to decide what side of the fence they want to sit on.
Mm.
And momentum can help bring you to the right change early, if you look at it that way. And Japan has reached the end of the road. They've got an aging population, they're heavily indebted.
Mm-hmm.
So they need to get their GDP growing somehow. And Japan has always resisted any immigration. If you've been there, you'll receive very few immigrants in Japan. And they've always had a female workforce that was highly educated, but only ever had one child and never came back to work.
Mm.
So they've now moved the female participation rate to US levels in 5 years.
Hmm.
Most people wouldn't even be aware of that.
Yeah, I didn't know that. They've
changed immigration policies literally this week. Huh. They're moving to an Australian-style visa program. Huh. And whether it's successful or not, no one believed they could get female participation rate up. They did it. Like, Japan's a country, when it decides it wants to do something, it can do something.
Yeah.
And the stocks are cheap. So do you know that what the PE of the topics is, which is the equivalent of the ASX 200?
No.
12 times.
Well, yeah.
Like, everyone remembers Japan on 100 times, on 50 times, most expensive one. Do you know what the average yield is on these stocks now? Like 3%.
Wow.
Like, these businesses, now, yes, they're more cyclical, they should be cheaper, compared to 18, 19, 20 times in the US, there's still businesses, world leaders in like robotics, etc., that you can buy great businesses there. We think things are really getting better for shareholders because one of the hard things about Japan was shareholders was not what they cared about. They cared about making the best Toyota car they could make. Mm. For them, they're perfectionists. They never really cared about capital allocation. So one thing is when you're on a PE of 12, you can actually pay out a 50% payout ratio, have a 4 to 5% yield and still grow your business. Mm. And they've all got net cash in their balance sheet, so they can buy back shares as well. They can add a little bit of leverage to their balance sheet. The US is over-leveraged.
Mm.
Japan is under-leveraged. There's nothing like having a crisis, a near-death crisis, to make yourself concerned. So whether it works out or not, we see that was an area that is a great opportunity in it.
Yeah, great. It's certainly it's unique in so at least the Australian funds management industry somewhat, so it's a good take. As we come to the end of the discussion now, I want to talk to you about Morphic and where you see the business going in the next 3 to 5 years. So where do you see it in the next five?
Well, if you'd asked me 5 years ago, I don't know if I'd give the same answer. It's one thing I've learned in life over my experiences living in different countries and that, is you can have a mud map of where you want to go, but the world very rarely lets you go exactly where you want to go. Mm. But you need a mud map. Yep. Can't it not have a mud map? Look, someone said to me, you're a five-year overnight success. Mm. I look at Jeff Wilson upstairs, and yep. They're now building. They're a 20-year overnight success. Mm. One thing about this industry is, unlike playing football or sports, you don't become successful in a year or two. Mm. We've built a team here. We've got 11 people. We started with three. The other way I think of it is that we launched in a one-square room. All of us was in one room. Mm. On Macquarie Street with three people. We had flat pack boxes from IKEA and we had no screwdriver and we put them together with a 10-cent coin.
That's great.
And Jeff came in over the weekends because the desks didn't fit properly with a saw and chopped off the bottom of the desks so our legs could fit through them. And we launched with $3 million in hope. We're at $200 million. We've got two funds, major funds now. We're just launching a European fund. We're raising money over there. Mm. I think last count we have a couple of thousand separate investors.
Great.
So it's been a journey to get to here. Where do I want to go? One thing though is we won't be Magellan. I respect the business they've built, but running one thing about long short is shorting, you need a certain amount of what's called borrow.
Yeah.
For me to short a stock, I need to be able to borrow it. And the biggest risk for a shorter is you get squeezed.
Mm.
You get stuck short a stock you can't get out of.
Mm.
And then, as any of your listeners will know, stocks can go into infinity, but they can only ever go to zero in the other direction.
Mm.
I.e. my losses could be infinite.
Yep.
So you have limits on the amount of money you can run from doing this. So we think it's maybe $2 to $3 billion,
yep.
Which is still a long way away.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, I think we can build a very good business. And I just think ESG and ethical investing is, at Hunter Hall, no one, if you'd asked me then, I would have said, look, I've been here 5 years. And yes, there's some interest, but I'm not certain if this will ever catch on in the broader community.
Mm.
I think climate change, millennials in particular, millennials have a very different view of the world. A statistic I was quoting in Europe is 75% of millennials, when asked, what do you want from your investment? Returns was number two.
Hmm.
They want to know that the company is doing something that's better for the world. They want to make money.
Yeah.
The baby boomers have the exact opposite.
Hmm.
The millennials are different. And the investment community is not fully adapted to understanding that millennials will be inheriting a lot of money in the next 10 to 20 years.
Hmm.
And look, I love capitalism, and I don't love socialism. And I'm a capitalist, I'm an economist, and I think capitalism is one of the greatest creations of mankind. But I do think capitalism did lose its way in the last 30 years, and we wrote a piece on our website about this, that if you go back 100 years, capitalism used to be more inclusive in some ways. You think of J.D. Rockefeller, they may not have been nice people, but they gave a lot to charity and they did other things. The idea that profit should only be the only thing a business ever does is sort of a 1980s construct.
Mm.
So people say we're going to socialism. I'd say caring about your employees and your staff and the environment that you operate in is actually going back to, I'd say, more inclusive capitalism.
Mm.
Germany and Scandinavia operates with a very successful capitalism that's more inclusive.
Mm.
Because I don't think your capitalism adapts. The shareholders, the millennials, etc., and the world may not tolerate capitalism. So I see lots of interesting change, and I think a larger room for ESG and ethical investing in it.
Yeah, I think you've got some good times ahead of you. While we're on that, it's open to retail investors, right?
Yeah, so we have a couple of different vehicles.
Yep.
So the easiest one for retail investors is the LIC.
Yep.
So the ticker is MEC.
Mm-hmm.
Trading at a discount to NAV, so I'd suggest it's a very good time to buy.
Yep.
We do pay divvies, frank divvies on that.
Yeah,
so, Jeff Wilson, who runs an excellent business, has given some advice about best ways to work there. We do two road shows a year.
Mm.
We've got another one coming up in November where we get out and meet as many people as possible. Mm. We do blogs. We do things like this. We have a weekly information. There's plenty. You can have as much to do with your superannuation as little to do with it as what you want. We do video updates as well. And we have a unit trust that's offered. So if you're doing a self-managed super, it's through a number of platforms like Panorama or you can come direct as well through that as well.
Yeah, $5,000 minimum. Is that right?
$10,000 minimum. Yeah, but for the mech, it's obviously one share or
through your brokerage account.
Through your brokerage account.
Yeah, right. It's a good place to go. It's the website. You can subscribe to the newsletter, like you say.
Yeah, so morphicasset.com has sign up to the newsletter. We do also a half yearly report.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do quarterly, we do video. Millennials prefer the video.
We do.
And if we'll just look at our shareholder base, we have this barbell. A lot of older people who actually, as in some people believe, that some millennials perhaps believe, the older people don't care, they do. And millennials obviously very engaged. Mm-hmm. May not have as much money, but they're very engaged. On their website, and our half yearly runs 20 odd pages, gives you an outlook. And we always finish up a little bit lightheartedly, things that won't happen in the next half. So things that we believe will not happen, called our anti-forecasts.
Right, great. Interesting question, and I believe that you guys are invested in your own funds, correct?
Oh, absolutely.
Yep. Would you invest with anyone? Would you invest with another fund manager who didn't have that alignment?
I don't know whether that's all right, but my answer would be no. I think there's two parts to it. I do get asked the question a lot. One part is I don't invest PA anymore.
Yep.
One part is I don't have the time. As in, my investors should know this is what my sole focus is.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, I would have liked hire staff for them to know at some point in their career they did it, but I'm quite busy these days, and my investors should know that this is what I'm doing, not punting on the side. Secondly, is obviously I don't want to be putting myself in conflict with my investors. So yes, so if I want exposure to markets, and I think I'm good at my job, of course I should have money in my fund.
Yeah.
But I don't believe it's incumbent that you have all your wealth in the fund. Just like no investor would all put all their wealth in one thing.
Mm.
I would actually say any fund manager who's that's all they've ever done probably doesn't understand risk management.
Mm.
But at the same time, I would be very disappointed if my fund manager did not have at least a decent chunk of their equity exposure. If you're 65, you probably shouldn't have 100% of your wealth in equities.
Mm.
So expecting your fund manager to do it probably says he doesn't actually follow his own rules.
Mm.
But he should have a decent exposure to it as well.
And final question, Chad, my favourite. If you go back in time and change just one thing, or you could tell the younger you something about money, finance or investing, what would it be?
I think markets climb a wall of worry.
Mm-hmm.
And I've now been through two recessions since I started, or bear markets, the US one in 2000, 2001, and then 07, 08. We might have another one. I just turned 40 this year. I'll be up on three. And after each one of them, I found reasons why things would not get better. And when you're a long-term investor, that long-term time horizon pays off. And if I look back, I never really had an... funnily enough, I gave the advice to people, and I never followed my own advice, was patience and a long-time horizon. Like, we've had lots of stuff go wrong. We've had a GFC. And yet markets have all gone, and there's always a reason why it won't go up. And that's why equities generate you such good return. Yet very few people actually make out of equities what the return of equities were. If you want me to expand on that a little bit more, which just means there's this conundrum that the return of a fund, so that's the dollar-weighted return of a fund, is different to the time-weighted return.
Mm.
So how that... to translate that into English, is investors nearly always tend to pull their money out the lows and put their money in at the highs.
Mm.
So they get bearish, they don't do anything, and then they go, oh, look, things are actually getting better. And by the time they got to that point, they're too late.
Mm.
And I'd say follow my own advice and write some rules down earlier.
Mm.
No one will be able to see it, but these were bear market rules given to me on my wall. It's a yellowing piece of paper now because it's coming up on 10 years old. I printed it out in 08. Some simple rules that you stick to, might be stop losses, what to do, writing a trade diary, will make you a vastly better investor than what you were. And it took me a long time to learn those two things.
That's great. So advice would be maybe think about what you want to get out of investing, write them down, and put them somewhere you remember.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Just one last one on that. This is what you want out of investing. I didn't know you were going to say that. Jeff, my head of risk, says people get out of markets what they want.
Mm.
If you want to be unhappy, you will create an outcome for yourself that you want.
Mm.
Ask yourself, what do you want from equity markets? Do you want to be rich? Do you want to be engaged? Do you want a hobby? And if you don't ask yourself that question, you won't know why you're in markets. If you don't know why you're in markets, you're the bunny in the trade. Mm. There's no right or wrong answer, but the answer to the question will sort of define what you should be doing in markets as well. Mm. I don't think enough professional investors ask themselves that. They don't know why they come to work. They want a bit of money, but they don't really understand. I think it's incredibly important to know what you want out of markets.
That's great. Great advice, Chad. Thank you for your time and all of your insights. I wish you all the best with Morphic.
Thanks again for tuning in to the Australian Investors Podcast. For further episodes, head to www.raskfinance.com. To provide feedback, nominate a guest, or hear from me, you can find me on Twitter with the handle @OwenRask. Cheers to our financial futures.